This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It used to be that Netflix excited its subscribers with the sound of a red paper envelope torn open to reveal a DVD inside. Remember that? But these days, Netflix sounds very different. Those were the themes from House of Cards, Stranger Things, Narcos, Arrested Development, and of course the Netflix logo sound at the top. Today the streaming service has more than 120 million subscribers worldwide. It has changed how we consume media and changed the conversations about race, inclusion, and representation in entertainment. Big names like Shonda Rhimes, Adam Sandler, and the Obamas all have production deals with Netflix. How did this company go from red envelopes to leaving Hollywood green with envy? And if it keeps growing at this pace, what will that mean for TV and movie fans like you and like me? That's just ahead on 1A.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
Hi, I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of the podcast Hidden Brain. This summer, we're sharing a series about reinventing yourself. We call it You 2.0. Add us to your summer listening for ideas about responding to life's messiness and chaos with wisdom.
Let's discuss it with Tom Noonan, a film and TV producer who is the executive producer of the Oscar-winning film Crash. He is a graduate school lecturer at UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and Television, also the former president of NBC Studios and of UPN, the United Paramount Network. Tom, welcome to 1A.
Thanks, Joshua.
Amanda Lotz is a professor of media studies at the University of Michigan. She's a fellow at the Peabody Media Center and the author of We Now Disrupt This Broadcast, How Cable Transformed Television and the Internet Revolutionized It All. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to join you.
And Steven Zajcik is a reporter covering the entertainment business for The Washington Post. He's also a former entertainment reporter for the LA Times. Steven, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you, Joshua.
We should note that we invited Netflix executives and producers to take part in this conversation. As is their wont, they declined, but the door remains open. We'd be happy to speak to them. Although, Amanda, I wonder, Professor Lotz, starting with you, if that's even surprising. I mean, Netflix is kind of running its life on its terms. It's sitting very, very pretty right now. Can you give us a sense of exactly how pretty Netflix sits in the entertainment industry today?
Well, Netflix is clearly the sector leader. It has aggressively really moved itself from one business to another. Not only, as you mentioned, has it transitioned from being a service primarily distributing movies by mail to now distributing mostly television, actually, as a streaming service. So it has pivoted its business a number of times, and it began making those pivots before it was clear that there was an audience that was interested in watching television over distributed to them by internet.
Tom Noonan, we should also be clear that Netflix is not just kind of a leader in the dollars and cents sense, but also in the awards sense. Netflix ended HBO's streak this year as the network with the most primetime Emmy nominations. HBO's had that streak for 17 years. This year, HBO got 108 nominations. Netflix got 112. What do you make of that?
Well, it just goes to their commitment to quality and credibility, and they're basically just trying to communicate with the consumer as clearly and as loudly as possible that we're not only providing you what you want, but we're providing you the best of what you want.
And also, Tom, I wonder if it also kind of communicates to the rest of the business that they want to play on the highest level. I mean, some people have looked at the TV business these days and said that producers and directors and writers can kind of do the sort of edgy, original, sophisticated work on TV that they used to have to go through the Hollywood movie machine to do. It seems like Netflix is trying to be in those ranks also.
Indeed. I mean, you know, you have to give a lot of props and acknowledgement to premium cable and basic cable for forging the way first by creating this new relationship with what CNN recently called the platinum age of TV in the early 2000s that we're still enjoying now. And Netflix has ridden that wave to basically tsunami-like levels now.
Steven Zajcik, let's zoom out a little bit further beyond just Netflix. There is a merger craze sweeping the media world right now. There's Disney buying up the assets for 21st Century Fox, outbidding Comcast, which owns NBC Universal. AT&T just absorbed the media assets of Time Warner, turned it into Warner Media. That was a deal that President Trump was vocally, very publicly against. How much of this is a reaction to Netflix?
I think a good deal of it is, and that's been what's so remarkable over the last few years, is not only to watch Netflix's ascent, which has been meteoric, but also to see how other companies are positioning or in many cases repositioning themselves. As you say, you know, AT&T recently was cleared by a judge to buy Time Warner, and Time Warner did not waste any time. The new CEO of Warner Media got up and basically said, we've got to compete with Netflix. We've got to invest in this company, particularly in HBO, to try to do that. You know, Disney, another great example, buying Fox, buying these very rich set of assets, because what they're essentially saying is Netflix is spending $8 billion on content this year. A lot of that is in new shows, original shows, new movies. They're often outspending the competition. If we don't scale up, we're going to get beaten by them. And by the same token, you've got tech companies coming in too. You've got companies like Apple, like Amazon. So Netflix has really prompted, in addition to all its other sort of the effects it's kind of caused, it's also prompted this incredible amount of investment and, as you say, mergers on the part of other companies.
We're speaking to Steven Zajcik, who covers the entertainment business for The Washington Post, University of Michigan Media Studies Professor Amanda Lotz, and Tom Noonan, a film and TV producer and a lecturer at UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and Television. We'd love to hear from you, your questions or thoughts about the ascent of Netflix and what it means for either the business or for just the movies and TV shows you love to watch. What is your experience with Netflix? Are you digging the changes? Are you not digging the changes? How do you feel about the enormous array of content on Netflix? Is the service working for you? And what do you think of its continued growth? Email us 1a@wamu.org. Also, if you work in media, if you work in the entertainment industry, what's your experience been either with Netflix or competing with Netflix? 1a@wamu.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1a. I wonder, though, Professor Lotz, if part of the success of Netflix is a little simpler than that. I mean, there are certain things that Netflix has just done for people who love to watch movies and TV that the other networks, the other studios, flat out refused to do. One listener described the joys of binge-watching in a message he left through our app 1A Vox Pop.
I really like the Netflix model of having shorter series of their original content that is almost, it seems, made to be binge-watched. I think if you spread it out over multiple weeks, you know, watching an episode per week, it doesn't have the same effect as if you watch it, you know, all in a weekend or something like that. You know, it kind of seems more like an extended movie, if you will, and I really like that.
Thank you to Caleb and Austin for leaving us that note. Professor Lotz, Netflix just decided they weren't going to play by Hollywood's game. We're going to give people exactly what they want, exactly when they feel like it. And to be honest, Hollywood knew that this was a possibility and refused to let us fans have that until Netflix forced them to.
Well, I think there's two key aspects on what allows Netflix to provide the service that it does. The first is technology, the fact that it's internet distributed and that form of distribution allows us to have that kind of on-demand access, as opposed to broadcasting cable, which technologically needs to send one thing to everyone at the same time. And so that's a key difference on the technology side. On the economic side, it's important to remember that Netflix is a subscription-based business, like HBO, but very different from the rest of television. And that advertising basis for television is what has driven the industry to focus on timeliness. It's very concerned with who is watching when. Are they watching the shows? Because then they're watching the commercials. So those are the two big differences in Netflix as a service that allows it to do things that are so different from the broadcast and cable channels.
Now, back in 2016, as Netflix was beginning to ramp up its spending on original content, the company's chief content officer, Ted Sarandos, spoke about the future of television on a roundtable with The Hollywood Reporter. In the middle, you'll briefly hear Lacey Rose, who's the TV editor for The Hollywood Reporter. But here's part of what Ted Sarandos said.
We have a one-on-one relationship with our subscribers.
Uh-huh.
If you don't like what you're watching on Netflix, or if you're not impressed enough with what you're watching on Netflix, you just one-click cancel.
Right.
And you can't do that with anyone here. And so that does make a, we have to make noise. We have to,
sure.
We are part of our business mandate here is, right, we're making event television. And it ain't cheap. It's not a cheap thing to do. So we have to take those big swings every once in a while. And you're not, we're not competing, you know, against ABC sitcoms. We're competing against Pokemon Go. We're competing against the, you know, $200 million blockbuster movies. We're competing in a really noisy world for attention. For some of these shows,
well,
and,
do you
and
have
I think
the same
bringing
issue
Baz Luhrmann to television is, and, you know, I think there was a lot of press around whether or not like this runaway budget. It wasn't. We knew going in that when you work and make a Baz Luhrmann production, it's not going to be cheap, but it's going to be spectacular.
That's Netflix's chief content officer Ted Sarandos speaking to The Hollywood Reporter. Tom Noonan, what's your reaction to what Ted said there?
Well, I think it's really smart that they're not thinking in such a limited manner as the broadcast networks and the basic cable and premium cable have all sort of thought in the past. Like Netflix is playing with an entirely different playbook. We've gone through an era over the past 20 years or so where everything but broadcast TV has become more and more niche. Everything is smaller and smaller and smaller. And Netflix comes along and says, nope, we want to be all things to all people. And that was disruptive beyond anyone's imagination. And the thing that was even crazier about it was they pulled it off.
Jax tweeted, Netflix has saved television. Before Netflix's original content, television had become abysmal. They've saved us from the doldrums of 2000s reality TV garbage and endless commercials. Steven Zajcik, what about that? Was Netflix an idea that was inevitable? Had consumers gotten to the point where they were ready for someone, anyone, to save them from what's on TV?
Well, I think there's a certain degree of truth to it. I mean, clearly Netflix has upped the quality and upped the quantity of available offerings and as we've been saying, forced everyone else to do the same. I don't think it's true in the sense that they were inaugurating this idea of premium high-end television. I mean, you know, long before Netflix came along, HBO was doing shows like The Sopranos and Sex and the City. And, you know, Showtime, of course, you know, has been doing great high-end programming for a long time as well. So I don't think that, yes, certainly broadcast television and even some cable networks have done have descended to the bottom of the barrel. But I also think that there have been some other companies that have been doing this very well. I think what Netflix has done is taken that model and just scaled it up to a remarkable degree. So now you have, you know, instead of just a few high-end shows every year or every season, you have dozens of them. And because everyone else wants to compete with Netflix, you have those networks and services doing, you know, dozens and scores of these shows as well. So I do think the listener is correct in that there's a lot more out there because of Netflix. But I also think the idea of high-end premium television is something others have done very well and will continue to do very well.
Professor Lotz, it's also interesting how Netflix is recruiting or marketing to younger audiences, to more diverse audiences. It started producing some fairly compelling promotional content to market its programs. There's a series of webisodes called Strong Black Lead that feature one-on-one conversations between black actors who star in Netflix shows. One of the earliest featured Kayla McLaughlin, who plays Lucas on Stranger Things, and Lena Waithe, who plays Denise on Master of None. Here they are talking about another one of Caleb's roles. He played in a biopic about the 80s pop group New Edition that aired last year on BET.
What's something you wish people knew about you?
A lot of people don't realize that I'm a performer and I sing, dance.
Yeah, we found that out. New Edition.
A lot of people don't even know about New Edition. Like,
oh, wow.
Especially like some of my Stranger Things fans, they don't know about that.
Oh yeah, no, so, people with Master of None, you know, don't watch The Shy.
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah. Okay. It's very different audience.
Yeah, it's very different. But
so black people know you now.
Mm-hmm.
Because of New Edition.
New Edition.
White folks know you because of Stranger Things.
Yes. And then you have that black audience that will. That know Stranger Things and New Edition.
There's a few unicorns.
Mm-hmm, yes, yeah.
Those were Lena Waithe, who plays Denise on Master of None, and Kayla McLaughlin, who plays Lucas on Stranger Things. Professor Lotz, what do you make of this strategy in terms of webisodes like Strong Black Lead and how Netflix markets?
Well, I think it's taking advantage of its opportunity to reach particular audiences with different promotional material. I read an interview once with Ted Sarandos, their head of content, and he was explaining that the worst thing that can happen is for Netflix to put a show in front of an audience that it wasn't meant for, because all of a sudden the word of mouth becomes very negative. And so the fact that they can push content like what you've watched before or talent that has starred in shows that you've watched before to specific audience members really does allow them to pull in their audience members and construct sort of a greater passion or interest in that specific content, as opposed to the way that everything else is marketed to us, which is, you know, sort of these general, very brand messages, broad messages. And, you know, in order to be marketed or created at all for that kind of mass market content, it has to be likely to succeed with the mass market.
I wonder, Professor Lotz, though, if there's a risk in that. I mean, we've talked a lot about Silicon Valley and its issues with diversity and inclusion, and I can imagine that there is a risk in terms of trying to market programs that are for you as opposed to programs that are not for you. It would seem possible, if not easy, for, say, a program with a strong female lead never to be offered up to a guy who likes action movies, or a program about the black experience never to be offered up to someone who likes Blue Collar Comedy Tour or Jeff Dunham. Is there a risk in there in deepening the cultural silos that we're in because Netflix is just so good at telling us what we want?
I think what's been interesting to me about Netflix is the degree to which they seem to be focused on types of stories far more than the traditional demographic boxes that have structured how we think about television that was ad-supported, and that whole thinking came from advertisers and their interest in buying particular demographics of attention. And so I think actually that, and again, this is this wide open question because Netflix does guard its data so closely, I think that based on some of the production they're doing, I think they're actually identifying surprising connections that transcend just sort of this basic thinking about identity, but taste communities that transcend identity groups and that can be identified both within countries and increasingly internationally as well.
We'll continue our conversation with Stephen Zaitchik, Professor Amanda Lotz, and Tom Noonan. Seems that Netflix can kind of do everything. I'm wondering if there are certain things that Netflix can't do or won't do. Does that leave a possibility for the legacy networks to have a future in a world ruled by Netflix? Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Did you know you can set your Amazon Echo to give you the news every morning? Just say, enable up first. Then tomorrow, say, what's the news? And start your day with up first.
Back now to our conversation with Tom Noonan, Professor Amanda Lotz, and Stephen Zaitchik. Cindy emailed, as a Korean American, I'm very appreciative that Netflix provides a good variety of popular Korean movies and TV shows. I was shocked to see the Netflix original sign on a Korean TV show that I thought was not a Netflix original. It is frankly annoying that Netflix seems to be getting credit for Korean shows that Netflix did not produce. What qualifies a show to be a Netflix original? Stephen?
Well, I think that the listener is correct in that there's often a blurring of the lines between what is considered and I should say this is not just true for Netflix. This is true across Hollywood where companies put their logos on shows or films that they had very little to do with. And in Netflix's case in particular, I think because they're producing and distributing in sometimes equal measure or sometimes less equal measure a lot of content, it can get a little bit blurry. I know that $8 million figure we all like to toss around, every pundit likes to toss around, actually applies not just to their originals but to everything that they're – this $8 million they're spending on – $8 billion, sorry, I should say, they're spending on content this year. That said, I do think that they are producing a lot of original shows that are that they should get credit for. In Korea, for example, right now they've got – a variety show they've done called Busted that I think is doing quite well. They've got a drama that I don't think has hit the service yet, but they're producing and quite far along on, called Love Alarm. So, you know, I don't know which show, of course, the listener was referring to, but I do think in a lot of countries these are originals that Netflix actually had a lot to do with. And that really speaks to this other part of the strategy, which is to not just, as Amanda was saying, not just go broad as far as different sort of taste clusters in the States, but really go around the world. They're very active in India. They're very active, you know, really throughout Asia. Obviously, they're very active in Europe and in South America. And so they're really starting to kind of figure out that these niches and these countries are more than niches around the world, are where their subscribers are going to come from, and produce original content there.
Professor Lotz, one of Netflix's most popular shows in many countries is Narcos, which takes place amid the drug war in Colombia in the 90s. Here is a clip of DEA agent Javier Peña, played by Pedro Pascal, from season 3 of Narcos.
Por favor, pongan atención. Necesito que metan todos los celulares, beepers y radios en el balde.
Is this necessary, Agent Peña?
I'm afraid so, Captain. My guy says one of your guys is working for the cartel.
They have any proof?
Can't say yet. But this warrant will be hard to execute if they're one step ahead.
Pedro Pascal playing Agent Javier Peña in Narcos. Professor, tell us more about how Narcos fits into Netflix's global strategy.
I think that the success of Narcos was an important early lesson, because the data that Netflix got back contradicted a general belief in Hollywood in the United States about what American audiences would watch, and the assumption that there just was not a big enough audience in the U.S. that would watch dubbed or subtitled programming, which a lot of Narcos is. It is in Spanish, and if you don't speak Spanish, then you're reading the subtitles. And I think from that experience and recognizing how well Narcos did not only in South America, but in the States and throughout other markets, they've come around to this idea that, you know, another taste community or cluster that's out there, you know, can be built by collecting audiences of certain genres, maybe sci-fi, maybe police procedurals, and that it matters less to those audiences where they're set and what language that is spoken than the nature of the programming itself.
Still time to get in some more of your questions and thoughts on Netflix. I'm kind of curious to hear from those of you who are not Netflix subscribers. Why have you not subscribed? And I'm not judging, but I'm just curious. Why have you not subscribed to Netflix? And what would it take to get you to subscribe? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A or comment on our Facebook page. Tom Noonan, there has been some criticism of Netflix's show called Marseille, which was marketed to audiences in France. Why did that show get criticized?
Well, it was an interesting effort. You know, they went after France's biggest star with Gerard Depardieu, and they, I think, were trying to establish a relationship with the French community that was as startling and as exciting as the House of Cards relationship would be in the United States. And unfortunately, that show just didn't live up to the excellence of House of Cards' first season in terms of execution. And that's going to be the case from time to time as Netflix expands into territories and with showrunners and with talent that they're not as familiar with, and they're not as closely supervising or possibly folks that just haven't had the same track record as the team behind some of these first efforts in the United States. That's going to be a risk for them expanding around the world at this scale. You know, when are they providing content that is at the level of Narcos, and when are they providing content that's closer to Marseille? It's always going to be risky with any new show that they premiere, but I'm sure it was frustrating for them to go out with something that was so high profile in this new territory that was so important to them and not get the same love that House of Cards did when it premiered.
Howard wrote on our Facebook page, "What I appreciate about Netflix and other media providers, I'm a Hulu fan as well, is the originality of programming. I'm no longer watching recycled network TV actors and plot lines. Netflix original series and movies offer fresh concepts and incredible production quality." Animal History Museum tweeted, "I wish Netflix would market shows like Strong Black Lead to me. I would like to check it out. Sincerely, a middle-aged white woman." And Larry emailed, "I still get DVDs by mail because the Netflix streaming service offers very few Oscar-nominated and Oscar-winning films. Many streamed films are just junk." I'd love to hear from the three of you about the business of Netflix. The CEO and co-founder of Netflix, Reed Hastings, spoke to Chris Anderson at TED 2018 about how much money Netflix spends on original content. Listen.
And I mean, this coming year, the level of investment you're planning to make in new content is not $100 million. It's what?
It's about $8 billion around the world. And it's not enough. There are so many great shows on other networks, and so we have a long way to go.
But $8 billion, that's pretty much higher than any other content commissioner at this point?
You're no, right up there, right? Disney's in that realm, and if they're able to acquire Fox, they're even bigger. But and then really that's spread globally, and so it's not as much as it sounds.
Sure, it's not. That's Netflix CEO and co-founder Reed Hastings. I wonder, Stephen Zajcik, what you make of Netflix's strategy and whether or not Netflix is on a path to sustained profitability. I mean, it kind of feels like they're just throwing money against the wall to see which shows stick, and they're so opaque in some ways about their business strategy. It's not like, you know, NBC puts 10 new series out there, one of them is profitable, and it pays for the 9 that failed. We're kind of unclear as to whether or not Netflix's strategy makes business sense.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the big questions a lot of people have about Netflix, which is, you know, it's great that we're all able to watch these shows, but how do they justify these costs? And, you know, look, any company, as it's ramping up, often has to spend a lot of money to make a lot of money, and hopefully eventually that kind of nets out in a positive way for them. But, you know, these kinds of deals we've been talking about, you know, whether it's $8 billion in content around the world or, you know, $300 million for Ryan Murphy, as his deal was reportedly worth, I think raises a lot of questions about what the business model really could be. You know, they're still in growth mode. They've got about 125 million subscribers. They want to get potentially to 200 within the next few years, and I think that does mean spending a lot of money. It also means, you know, you've got a lot of great content creators who are at other companies. You've got to woo them. You've got to spend a lot. But at some point, you know, since they're not making any money on advertising and they're really not making any money on any individual show, you've got to ask whether this is worth it. On their recent earnings call, I just should point out, one of the executives had brought that very point up, which is we have to find a balance between what we're spending, which is, of course, key if you're going to put all these great shows on the service, and what we're getting back in terms of subscribers. And at some point, no matter how much you've sort of built a better mousetrap and are able to figure out exactly who your shows are reaching, when you're spending that much on these content creators and on the content itself, you have to ask whether that's really worth it.
Tom Noonan, with regards to the profitability, I can't fault someone like Stephen Murphy or Shonda Rhimes for taking the 9-figure deal. I love my job today, but if Netflix offered me 9 figures to do a show, I don't know. I might not be here for the top of the hour. I might walk away. Like, I get it. I totally get the idea of taking this money, but it also feels a little weird. Like, I'm going to take all this money from someone who might not be on solid financial ground. I don't know. How do creatives in Hollywood feel about being part of this business that may or may not be sustainable?
Well, I really think that that's an outlier position at the moment, that people are scratching their chins about whether or not Netflix is going to be around. They may have had a blip last quarter, but, you know, there's over 7 billion people strolling around planet Earth right now, and they've got 125 million subscribers so far. And I just think that any kind of news of their imminent demise, you know, may be overestimated here. But when they're coming forward with these gigantic deals, I think they're being extremely selective about it. It's not like they're spending like drunken pirates, you know, and just throwing money at anyone who sails by. I mean, Shonda and Ryan have spent a career, decades, building their brands, as has Adam Sandler in his own way. And this isn't a sober business decision you know, by Reed and Ted and the group over there at Netflix. And even though the numbers sound astounding from the outside, I believe that they'll earn it in terms of future subscribers and quality content, you know, coming down the pipeline.
I got to say, Professor, I am a recent cord cutter. I'm kind of experimenting with it. And connection speeds are beginning to become a concern for me, too, with the various services that I use. Net neutrality has been a hot topic lately in terms of whether or not all web traffic will flow from all services to all users at an equally high speed. How might net neutrality affect Netflix's future?
It could have really severe implications. I think Netflix is probably one of the companies that the internet service providers, you know, such as Comcast or Verizon, those who you get your internet service from, I suspect that they have their eyes exactly on a service such as Netflix that is responsible for you know, attracting so many people who choose to use their internet service to stream the to stream Netflix. So now that we in the States are in a realm of, you know, not having net neutrality protection, it is lawful for our internet service providers to create different tiers of service that a provider such as Netflix would have to pay the ISP in order to make sure that they are delivering Netflix at speeds fast enough that viewers can enjoy the service. I think that's a fee that Netflix is likely to really have to pass on to viewers. And so I think, you know, that really very quickly changes their business equation and what they thought that they were able to be making in terms of profit may decrease as a result.
Hey, Stephen, before we have to go, I wonder if you see any areas of the business, of the entertainment industry, where Netflix might not be able to be dominant in the future. I mean, Netflix doesn't do news programming, lucky for us, because that would be a very gigantic disruptor to our business model. Is there a future in which Netflix cannot be ubiquitous? Are there areas of the media where we should just get used to having to flip to a different channel?
Oh, well, I think there are. And I think, you know, this sort of whole question about Netflix's dominance, you know, Tom was just alluding to it, is I don't think anyone's really questioning whether they're going to be around for the foreseeable future. I think they will be. But I think to your point, Joshua, precisely, the question is, can they continue doing it in as many realms as they'd like to do it, in as many countries as they'd like to do it, and spending as much as they'd like to do it? I mean, look, clearly this is a very popular service and they're on solid ground as far as, you know, the kinds of, content that will bring back those returns. But if you're starting to talk about some of these deals and you're not sure what they're going to be bringing back and you're talking about this level of expansion and subscriber levels are starting to plateau, I think they may have to pull the reins back. And, you know, as far as specific categories go, you know, there have already been some areas where they've been a little bit less successful, at least critically, and we think commercially. Live talk shows or talk shows, they did a David Letterman series not too long ago, and right. I don't think it had quite the resonance. So I think there are going to be certain things, sports they're not going to get into. Certainly for now, in these kind of high-end areas, they're doing quite well.
Steven Zajcik covers the entertainment business for The Washington Post. Steven, thanks very much.
Thank you.
University of Michigan Media Studies Professor Amanda Lotz, author of We Now Disrupt This Broadcast. Thanks, Professor.
Thank you.
And Tom Noonan, graduate school lecturer at UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and Television. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Joshua.
Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.